Hello, I'm Terrence McNally, and welcome to Free Forum, a world that just might work. I'm going to be speaking today with Thomas Homer Dixon, who has correctly predicted a lot of the crises we face these days. We're going to talk about his new book, Commanding Hope, The Power We Have to Renew a World in Peril. And you can learn more at Commanding Hope, one word, commandinghope.com. The show airs as specials on KPFK 90.7 FM in LA and streams weekly on the Progressive Voices Network on TuneIn. Podcasts are available anytime, anywhere on Apple Podcasts, most major podcast sites, and at my site, TerrenceMcNally.net, TerrenceMcNally.net. Let me just say, as we continue to confront the coronavirus pandemic, I encourage you to do your part by social distancing, wearing a mask in public, staying home, and by finding ways to help those in your community hurt most by the social isolation and the economic devastation. Now to today's conversation. Václav Havel, playwright, dissident, and president of Czechoslovakia, had something to say about hope. This is quoting Havel. "The kind of hope I often think about, I understand above all as a state of mind, not a state of the world. It is a dimension of the soul. It's not essentially dependent on some particular observations of the world or estimate of the situation. Hope is not prognostication. It's an orientation of the spirit, an orientation of the heart. It transcends the world that is immediately experienced and is anchored somewhere beyond its horizons. Hope, in this deep and powerful sense, it's not the same as joy that things are going well, or willingness to invest in enterprises that are obviously headed for early success, but rather an ability to work for something because it is good, not just because it stands a chance to succeed. The more unpropitious the situation in which we demonstrate hope, the deeper that hope is. Hope is definitely not the same as optimism. It is not the conviction that something will turn out well, but the certainty that something makes sense regardless of how it turns out. In this profound sense, a grateful heart is also a hopeful heart." For three decades, Thomas Homer Dixon has examined the threats to our future security. As humankind continued on its prevailing course, he predicted a deteriorating environment, extreme economic stress, the spread of diseases in globally connected systems, mass migrations, widespread social instability. His assessment? Without profound, systemic, new approaches, our planet will become unrecognizable as well as poorer, more violent, and more authoritarian. In response to his earlier books, The Ingenuity Gap and The Upside of Down, and his warnings, he's been called the Doommeister. But hope is a resource he feels we cannot afford to lose. And in his newest book, Commanding Hope, he weaves knowledge of how societies work and evolve, our cognitive abilities and capacity to handle threats, to suggest a new path for human civilization, but one that only reveals itself if we mobilize our minds, imaginations, and core values and pursue change collaboratively. Thomas Homer Dixon holds a university research chair in the Faculty of Environment at the University of Waterloo. That's in Canada. He's director of the Cascade Institute at Royal Roads University, British Columbia. His writing has appeared in Foreign Policy, Foreign Affairs, Scientific American, Washington Post, New York Times, Financial Times, Globe and Mail. And his latest book, as I said, is Commanding Hope, The Power We Have to Renew a World in Peril. Welcome, Thomas Homer Dixon, to Free Forum, a World That Just Might Work.
Hello, Terrence, and it's wonderful to be with you today.
Yeah. Just let me tell folks two things. One, I think our two previous interviews were in 2001 and 2006, so it's been, a decade and a half since we last spoke, and we're recording this conversation on Tuesday, December 22nd. So first of all, how are you? How are you coping with the resurgent pandemic or any of the other crises we face?
Yeah. Well, it's been an extraordinary year in so many ways. Right now, I'm looking out the windows of our house here on Vancouver Island. So I'm in the same time zone as you, out towards the Olympic Mountains. We're on a cliff overlooking the sea, the Strait of Juan de Fuca. So we're looking at the Olympic Peninsula in Washington State. It's a glorious sunny day after an enormous storm yesterday. We are not quite as severely locked down as California. But there are nonetheless pretty significant restrictions here in terms of social gatherings. People are only supposed to get together in within their families today or over Christmas. There's no travel. We're enjoined not to travel from, for instance, Vancouver Island to the mainland, or people from Vancouver aren't supposed to come here. And the really extraordinary thing, I mean, here I am looking at the United States 20 kilometers away, about 12 to 15 miles, and I can't go there, and you can't come here. It's I see the container ships coming in to Seattle and to Vancouver from China and elsewhere, but there's been a radical change in the last months in our sense of space and our sense of connectivity on the planet. So we're still trying to wrap our heads around that, I think. We're approaching a turning point with the pandemic, but in terms of deaths and sickness, the worst months are clearly going to be in front of us. January, February, this is a seasonal virus. It gets worst in the hemisphere that's in winter, and we're in winter right now. And the vaccine isn't really here yet, and it's not widely available. So we're in for a rough patch in the next few months. I think that's widely recognized.
Yeah, you know, for the first time, we actually do see there is a light at the end of the tunnel, with the vaccines emerging more rapidly than in history, and yet that tunnel is full of death.
That's right. But let's look at the extraordinary accomplishment which you just highlighted. I mean, we went from the identification of this virus basically early this year to the development of and distribution of a vaccine in about 10 months. And that was a worldwide effort. Not just Operation Warp Speed, although that certainly contributed. And the technology we were able to apply this time was unbelievable. The code, the genetic code for the virus, the RNA code, was deciphered in China, distributed around the world, and within literally a few days.
That's right.
The companies that were able to apply this new technology, I think it's called memory RNA technology, had developed the genetic code for the vaccine. They ran it into a computer and through their models, and they had the genetic code. They knew what the vaccine needed to look like. The what has taken the time since then is the testing, but the speed of our response, it makes you think that if we can do this, we should be able to solve problems like climate change. Human beings are just, when they apply themselves, are just extraordinarily creative.
Yes, and I mean, we will, I'm sure, you know, refer back to this perhaps in the course of the conversation, but I think the shared vulnerability and the collective effort that have gone into both dealing with the pandemic and then nurturing the vaccines is exactly what's needed for climate change and is what's needed for any of the deep and existential crises we face.
That's right. And the experience shows it's a very visceral experience of a tipping point for people. Most of us have operated on the assumption, quite understandably, that change is more or less incremental. Things shift a little bit from day to day, year to year. But there's sort of a more or less a linear trajectory that we're on, whether it's in technological change or social change. But complexity scientists, and I count myself as one, would say that actually increasing proportion of change in our world is going to be nonlinear. It's going to be punctuated. It's going to be sharp, sudden shifts in systems. And this was a very vivid example of that. I mean, within 4 weeks, basically, between mid-March and mid-April this year, 4 billion people on the planet locked down. We've never in the history of the species experienced such a sudden shift in such a large proportion of the behavior of the species in such a short period of time. I mean, it was just completely unprecedented. The concept of social distancing, or now often people call it physical distancing, was essentially unheard of by just about anybody on the planet but that concept went around the planet in probably 2 weeks, and people started to implement it. So this is There is change afoot here that we don't completely understand, but possibilities for novelty and for hope, as I talk about in my book, that we maybe haven't seen before.
Someone I've interviewed in the last few months, Robert Frank, the economist from Cornell, who had a timely book that he was just coming out with, called "Under the Influence: The Power of Peer Pressure, The Power of Social Contagion." And one of the things he points out is that very often we think of social contagion, peer pressure, as a negative. Kids smoke because their friends smoke. People become obese because their friends become obese. But he said the social contagion that transformed our behavior on the scale in which you just referred is, as you said, unheard of, historical, and potentially a very positive sign.
That's right. So within the new institute that I founded, working with a number of people here at Royal Roads University to set up the Cascade Institute, we're actually looking at what we call norm cascades. It's one of our research programs called the Norm Cascades Project. And we're interested in learning, in particular, from what's happened during the pandemic, how people's attitudes have shifted, and seeing how some of those lessons can be positively applied to, say, shifting attitudes on climate change. And I'd be very interested in reading Frank's work on this, but there's both an emotional component and an ethical component in a normative shift. So there's the ethical component that you feel you ought to behave in a somewhat different way because there's peer pressure, because you're seeing other people model a particular new behavior. So you feel that that's a direction you should go in. But there's also an emotional appeal. It might involve guilt, it might involve shame, but maybe positive emotions like awe and hope are can be evoked too. And I think the set of emotions surrounding the normative shifts during the pandemic have been very complex. And some of them have been positive, and some of them have been very negative too, an enormous amount of anger and fear. And we need to understand that better because these processes can be potentially mobilized for shifting humankind in positive directions.
Yeah, I mean, I would say in the U.S., a similar phenomenon, and I think very much impacted by the mutual experience of the pandemic, was the response to George Floyd's death and the largest, most sustained demonstrations in the nation's history. To me, the shared vulnerability we were already feeling to the pandemic led us to that as well.
Yes, I think so. There, it wasn't a coincidence that these things happened at the same time. I mean, the pandemic accentuated inequalities in our society. Frontline workers who in many cases were paid minimum wage and really on the cusp in terms of economic well-being were hit incredibly hard. And there was, in many societies, of course, a flood of resources and money to provide some protection, economic protection for these folks. But it was patchy. Institutions were rolled out very fast. Processes were rolled out very fast. But there was a larger sense that there are the winners in society who can retreat into their comfortable homes and have space around them, and the losers who still have to get out or have just lost their jobs or still have to get out and work in dangerous environments. And I think it primed, and then the other part of it, of course, is that everybody was on their screens
That's
during that
right.
period of time,
That's right.
basically almost 24/7. We were all doom scrolling, and we're all paying attention in this kind of new sphere, hyper-connected way around the planet to what was happening. And so the Floyd video had a staggering impact, a much more accentuated impact than it would have had normally in this situation of heightened emotional responsiveness to injustice and also just connectivity and awareness because people were sitting at home so much watching their, on the screen. So it was a moment, not a coincidental event, but it was as if the pandemic primed us for this conversation about social justice around the world, and that's in the wake of all the climate things that we've seen happening over the last years, the fires, the smoke, the floods, the storms, the hurricanes, some of which have continued, of course, during the pandemic. I mean, the
That's
situation
right.
in California has just been, I mean, we've been watching it here from the north in BC. Our fires weren't that bad this summer, but just luckily, the first time in several years they haven't been. But the catastrophic confluence of events in California during this past summer is just, I mean, so all your friends in Canada were just literally weeping for you down there. I
Yeah.
just.
And yet, you know, as you said, there's such an unequal distribution of impact. For me, you know, I'm able to stay in my home, you know, and it's not that, you know, my what happens to me when there's a fire, you know, I get ash on my car. You know, it's if I mean, they were the closest one was probably about 40 miles away,
Yeah.
but it was 40 miles away.
But the smoke was there.
The smoke was there,
Yeah, this.
and for some of us, my stepson who lives in Berkeley, he had his N95 mask already
Yeah.
from last year's fires.
Yes. And we had our, you know, and again, given our resources at our family, the smoke was incredibly dense here. Visibility dropped to about 100, 200 yards. And from Oregon. And some of the California smoke. And we had our two Dyson air filters, and we basically locked down the house and brought the kids home from school so they wouldn't be exercising outside. And we were okay. But there's something about the smoke and its pervasiveness and the way it filters into every aspect of your life, and the fact that you're breathing it inside, you're bringing this harmful substance inside your body. It's scary in a way that I think other impacts of climate change aren't. You know, there's a reason that we have a very few moral injunctions that are kind of moral bright lines as a species. You know, genocide is regarded as an uncontestable evil, as is, say, child prostitution, slavery. But one of the things that is up there in that list is use of chemical weapons in warfare, and you know, it's really odd because we can actually kill people in an infinite number of grotesque ways in warfare, and we do, and yet somehow the use of chemical weapons is regarded as particularly egregious, as particularly evil, and it's got something to do with this inhalation of poisons into our body and how that affects us emotionally. And the smoke from wildfires, I think, has the same emotional effect. And it may be that that's part of the emotional turning point surrounding climate change at the moment, because the smoke goes worldwide. The smoke from California ended up in Europe, right? It circles the entire hemisphere.
I would say two other things about that. One is that when the sky changes, it has some sort of a deep, I think a deep effect on us when, you know, I've seen it a lot this year. You know, there's a gray orange shift to
Yes.
the whole sky. That I think plays into things that humans have experienced when they looked up, you know, from time immemorial. The other thing I would say about chemical weapons is that part of it is the inability to aim a chemical weapon, you know, in other words,
Yes.
right? It's that you pretty
Indiscriminate.
much know you use a chemical weapon, you're indiscriminately affecting women, children, innocents, etc. You've mentioned the Cascade Institute. What I'd like you to do, Thomas, is tell us a bit. It's been, as I've said, 14 years since you and I have interviewed. So tell the listeners a bit about your path, and then take it through the Cascade Institute.
Sure. So I started out on Vancouver Island, where I am right now, back in the 1970s, BC boy, and but I felt that I couldn't really pursue my interests here on Vancouver Island. I was had the sense that I wanted to know more about the world, so I went east, and I basically spent 40 years out east in Ontario, and I did my doctorate at MIT. During the 1980s, during the Reagan arms buildup, I was very interested in the causes of human conflict. That's really what I wanted to study, and that's what I went east to study. So, the causes of war, the causes of genocide, of deep hatred, of mass violence. And when I went to MIT to do my doctorate, I was in a program that focused on the arms race between the United States and Soviet Union, its technological aspects, but also its underlying causes. And I pursued study again in the causes of conflict and international relations there. But I was always really interested in environmental issues too. And when I finished my doctorate in the late 80s, I decided to look at the relationship between environmental stress around the world. So things like water scarcity, deforestation, depletion of cropland, and how that could contribute to mass violence, to conflict, revolutions, civil disorder, ethnic strife, problems such as the genocide in Rwanda, where there are environmental or demographic factors in the background there, the stress and strife between Palestinians and Israelis, to what extent does water scarcity contribute to that? We looked at case studies, ultimately looked at case studies from all over the world. I ended up at the University of Toronto running a big research project on this subject during the 1990s. And out of that came an interest in how societies adapt to severe stress. And my first major book for a general audience, The Ingenuity Gap. And so the question there is, why do societies sometimes fail to respond to problems like environmental stress and then suffer internal disruption and breakdown? And then as my research evolved, I decided that I needed to understand sort of the underlying complexities of social change and social crisis. And that led me into a body of work called complexity science, which is where I've really been working for the last 20 years or so, 20, 25 years. In the last period of time, I've been at the University of Waterloo, working with, which is probably the best place in Canada to work on complex systems issues, and working with an extraordinary group of scholars there. And my work has become more prescriptive in that I've been looking more at what we can do to respond to the crises we face as a species. And it's become also, in some sense, more psychological and social psychological, so more focused on what's going on in our minds and how we need to change what's going on in our minds to solve problems like climate change more effectively.
Okay, and the Cascade Institute. This seems like a rare opportunity, given the path you've just described.
So it's really, in some respects, a kind of culmination of everything that I've been doing over the course of my career, of that 40-year period away. I had an opportunity to bring my family back to Vancouver Island, to my hometown. There's a small university here called Royal Roads University that's focuses on teaching mid-career professionals and people who are really interested in practice and changing things and changing the world. It has big ambitions and a really terrific leadership team, and they were keen to have me try to set up this institute within the context of the university. And then it really takes the ideas of complexity science and tries to use them and apply them to practical change. So one of the key things in complex system science is that systems, complex systems, which include human societies, economic systems, ecological systems, the climate, they have this capacity to shift their behavior in large ways very suddenly. We call that nonlinear behavior. And often the shifts can be the result of relatively small things, small perturbations or pushes that cause the very large shift. People have probably heard of the butterfly phenomenon, the idea that the flap of the wings of a butterfly at a certain point in time on one side of the planet could eventually cause a chain of events that produces a hurricane or a major weather event on the other side of the planet sometime later, say months later. And that's an example of a nonlinear response, or in the jargon of the field, sensitivity to initial conditions. So the question that the Cascade Institute is pursuing is it possible for humankind to turn this characteristic of complex systems to our advantage? Can we find what we would call high leverage intervention points, places where we can intervene in people's belief systems, in institutions, in technological systems, where we can push a little bit that could produce very large changes in the pathways we're taking more generally as a species and as societies. So we're dedicated to finding these high leverage intervention points, applying complex system science to find find these points where you can sort of stick a little lever in and pry open a possibility and produce an enormous change.
So there you've talked about your work path. Now let's look a little bit at the path of your books. So this is the third book you and I have spoken about, The Ingenuity Gap in 2001, The Upside of Down in 2006. And
yes,
two things. One, the evolution in your thinking that these books sort of track. But the other one is I noticed 5 years between the first two books and 14 before this one.
Yes, so because this one was way harder to write. So now I was producing a book about every 5 years.
Yeah.
My first and frankly only major scholarly book published by Princeton was Environment, Scarcity, and Violence.
Right.
That was published in 1999, and that was basically the culmination of that 1990s research project on environmental stress and violence. Mm-hmm. So it basically summarized everything we'd done over a decade, my research team and I. And then in 2000, I had The Ingenuity Gap come out, but I'd really started working on that about 5 years previously. Mm-hmm. And then again in 2006, I had The Upside of Down come out, and 2 to 3 years research, 2 years writing. But this last book was far harder. I'd actually intended in The Upside of Down to have a whole section at the end of the book that was highly prescriptive. I mean, the title, The Upside of Down, suggests that there's going to be some upside in the story. And a lot of critics quite rightly noted, well, this is a great diagnosis of the human circumstance. And there, you know, there's an enormous amount of interest in this book, but where's the upside? Mm-hmm. And part of it was that I kind of ran out of space and time. I was up to 120,000 words, and I hadn't really gotten deeply into the prescriptions, and we had to publish. We had to move the thing out the door. But the other part of it, I realize now, looking back, is that I wasn't ready. I didn't have my ideas formed, and so the book was published. It did well, but quite legitimately, people were saying, "And what next?" and so the third book was always intended to be more prescriptive, as I mentioned earlier. It was going to be talking about what we should do and what direction we should take in response to these challenges that I'd identified. And I started it in 2012. This kids intervened. Mm-hmm. My son was born in 2005, my son Ben, and then our daughter, Kate, was born in 2008. So the ability to focus enormous amounts of time on something like writing a book declined markedly for a number of years. But I started the book the latest book in 2012. And I started it twice. And twice over a period of 4 years, I wrote tens of thousands of words and ended up basically jettisoning them. I just threw them out. Because it was becoming a checklist. It was becoming sort of a list of, well, we should do this to our regulations. We should do this to our energy technologies. We need to behave better towards each other in these ways. And it was both kind of hortatory and trivial, and frankly repetitive, because lots of folks have done that kind of thing very well in their respective domains: energy technology, institutions, regulations, policy. They've done that kind of thing very, very well, and so it was going to be derivative basically of other people's work and not particularly interesting. Then about 2016, my father died in 2015, which as loss of a parent, was my second parent who died, and that had an enormous effect on my as it always does, on my larger sense of possibility in the cosmos, sense of mortality. And then in 2016, before Trump was elected, I remember I was sitting on this on the cliff in this property here on Vancouver Island, and I thought, the thing that gives me the most anguish, the deepest sense of despair, is the possibility that my children will emerge as adults into this world, into this future, and will lose hope. Mm. And I realized it was just an epiphany moment. I realized that is what the book had to be about. And now my agent and my publisher were not keen on this idea. They thought, a book about hope? You've got to be kidding. So that started an extended conversation and a voyage and thinking about what hope is and how it can be made more muscular and more potent in our lives. very much in the way Vaclav Havel talks about it in that quotation you read at the beginning. How can it be mobilized effectively as the starting point for our mass response to the challenges we face? And so then things started to come together. It was still an incredibly difficult book to write, far harder than the previous ones. But at that point, I think there was a turning point in the whole trajectory of things.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, in other words, that you have the epiphany, and then I'm guessing your agents, your peers, etc., your editors, and so on, begin to bring the rigor to the epiphany.
Yeah, well, that's it. But the first reaction is got to be kidding.
Right.
You've got to be kidding because you know, Barack Obama had mobilized the idea of hope in his 2008 presidential campaign.
Right.
And of course,
we've got the T-shirts.
Right. Absolutely. And it was very effective. But it seemed a bit anachronistic by the time we got into the middle of the 2010s. And this was even prior to Trump. Mm-hmm. And then with Trump, of course, the idea of hope seems sort of utterly naive. Mm-hmm. There are a number of standard critiques of hope. I go through them in the book.
The next thing I'm going to do actually is read a few quotes on hope and let you know.
Okay, so I'll leave that then.
Yeah.
I realized, and I have an absolutely wonderful editor in Canada, and I have an amazing editor. I work with two editors, I hire freelance in the States. And my Canadian editor, Louise Dennis, said, you know, you need ballast here. Mm. You need ballast for this idea of hope. So I went off, basically, and read an enormous amount of literature, especially in philosophy and positive psychology, and developed a theory of hope. Structured around three components. We'll talk about them, I'm sure: honest, astute, and powerful hope. And that provided kind of underlying framework for my thinking about hope. It was a very substantial challenge in itself. But with any trade publication like this, you also have to tell a story that draws people in. You have to have a narrative arc. You can't just lay out a theory. And so I needed protagonists. I needed individuals to follow. Two of them are my children,
right,
Ben and Kate. But there's another story in the book about a woman, an American woman, young woman in the 1950s, who's a mother and who mobilized mothers across the United States to stop the testing of nuclear weapons in the atmosphere. And that story, through a remarkable series of sort of serendipitous episodes, that story became a core plot line in my book that binds together my thinking about hope. So all of those pieces fell together between 2016 and 2020 or so. And then the pandemic hit. And then the editor said, we need to reconsider this book in the context of the pandemic. So at the very, very last minute, I had to go back and substantially rework the book from the first sentence to the last sentence. Mm. And it was already in page proofs at that point. It had been typeset and everything. So it was quite an ordeal to get it to this point.
Very good. Okay, let me tell people this is Free Forum, A World That Just Might Work. I'm Terrence McNally. I'm speaking with Thomas Homer Dixon. Over the years, he's correctly predicted a lot of the crises we face. But we're talking about his new book, which he was just describing, the challenges and the journey. Commanding Hope, The Power We Have to Renew a World in Peril. And you can learn more at Commanding Hope, one word, commandinghope.com. So let me just, first of all, you say that hope has a bad rap in popular discourse. As you said, there is critique of hope as naive and worse. And let me read a couple of those, because I have them right at hand, and then some other folks' takes on hope, and then I want you to, you know, jump in. So,
sure.
U.S. Rear Admiral Jean LaRoque, you quote, "If we want a better world, we as human beings ought to do what we can to bring about the change. Hoping is a futile mental exercise." Derek Jensen, the environmentalist, essayist, someone who is quite a profound thinker, The more I understand hope, the more I realize that it serves the needs of those in power, as surely as belief in a distant heaven. That hope is really nothing more than a secular way of keeping us in line. Hope is, in fact, a curse, a bane, a longing for a future condition over which you have no agency. It means you are essentially powerless. Now, on the other hand, Rebecca Solnit, who wrote Hope in the Dark, she says, and I'm going to quote her, your opponents would love you to believe that it's hopeless, that you have no power, that there's no reason to act, that you can't win. Hope is a gift you don't have to surrender, a power you don't have to throw away. An embrace of the unknown and the unknowable, an alternative to the certainty of both optimists and pessimists. And that note, by the way, was one that I really liked, that both pessimists and optimists are certain. Hope is not exactly certainty. And then Patrice Cullors, one of the founders of Black Lives Matter, early on when people asked what the mission was, she said to provide hope and inspiration for collective action to build collective power to achieve collective transformation, rooted in grief and rage, but pointed towards vision and dreams. So, your reflections on A, what I just read, but also your look into the deeper meanings of hope.
Yes. So I'm clearly on the positive end of the spectrum with respect to my attitude towards hope. I'm quite receptive to the critiques, so I take them seriously. They suggest that hope is often false, that it encourages us to bend the probabilities in our mind for the possible world we want, to think that it's more possible than it actually is, that it's naive. In many cases, it's naive because it doesn't have a clear vision of the future, and it's sort of just wishful thinking. And then perhaps most importantly, and I think this is reflected in both the Jensen and LaRocque perspectives, it's passive. It encourages us to simply wait passively for things, good things to come our way. I make a distinction in the book between hope that and hope to. Mm-hmm. The locution hope that, which is quite passive. I hope that it will be sunny tomorrow. Mm-hmm. Well, I can't really do anything about whether it's sunny or not. So in that sense, the passivity is probably warranted. But when you say you hope to do something, I hope to plant my garden tomorrow. I hope to work with people to keep climate warming to 2 degrees Celsius or less. It implies a sense of agency, possibility that I will engage. Hope to is always followed by a verb. It's an active form of hope. So I argue very strongly for hope to. I think Jensen is too fatalistic in an interesting sort of way about the possibility of change, even though he's arguing that we need to jettison hope to open up possibilities for change. I would argue exactly the opposite, that hope needs to be grounded in a very realistic understanding of the seriousness of the obstacles we face and of the power relations that are blocking change. But a hope to kind of hope can mobilize us, can give us a sense of possibility and agency that can help us push through and around those obstacles to actually break apart the power structures to produce the change we need. So I'm much more on the side of Solnit, for example, and of the folks within the Black Lives Matter movement who see hope as a starting point, a kind of necessary condition for anything else. And the other thing that you mentioned that I think is critically important is that hope exists in this realm of uncertainty. Mm-hmm. It turns uncertainty from a threat into a source of possibility. You can't hope for something that you know will come to pass because it just doesn't make sense. And you're not going to hope for something that you know is impossible because again, it just doesn't make sense. So hope exists in that gray area of uncertainty. Now, normally we find uncertainty to be very scary. It's a source of fear, quite legitimately. We don't know when the tiger is going to bounce out of the woods, for example. But it's in that uncertainty, too, that there are possibilities for our imagination. and to create new directions for change. And certainly becomes a resource in that sense. It becomes a source of possibility, especially to go back to what we were talking about before, in a complex world where small things can make a big difference. If that's the case, and we don't understand that complex world very well because there's a lot of high uncertainty, then let's go out and look for those small things. And the woman I was talking about before, Stephanie May, the Connecticut housewife in the 1950s, was able to take a small thing and literally change the world. Her mother's movement around the world was instrumental in producing the Partial Test Ban Treaty, which ultimately put nuclear testing underground. And there was nothing particularly remarkable about Stephanie May as an individual. So that possibility resides in all of us. And it started with hope. Stephanie May wouldn't have begun her campaign if she hadn't had hope.
That's right. And that point that you made, if something is inevitable, one needn't waste hope on that. And if something is impossible, it's foolish.
It's foolish to, exactly.
And so,
exactly, because if something is impossible, then the best you can do is wish for it.
Yeah.
You know, I wish I could fly. I know it's impossible, but I wish I could fly. But hoping implies that it's, there's no confidence, and this is a mistake that's often made, and this may be one of the places where I actually part company a bit with Václav Havel. Hoping doesn't imply a high probability that the desired future that you want is going to come to pass. It implies some possibility, some reasonable possibility. So what's the threshold? I have interesting conversations with young people these days who are desperately concerned about their future, about climate change. And sometimes they'll say, so what are the chances? What are the chances that we can have a positive future, a humane future, say 2100? I would say, well, maybe about 20%. And they look at me and they say, okay, I can deal with 20%. Let's get going and see if we can widen that possibility window a bit.
Wow.
You know, if somebody has cancer and they're given, somebody you love has cancer, if we have individually have cancer and we're given a probability of 20%, we're going to do everything we can to get ourselves into that 20% possibility. And that hope will drive us in that direction. So you don't need to have enormous confidence that the positive possibility is going to come to pass. You just need to know that it's realistic and how, what direction to go in to maximize that possibility. And this is where we are right now, right? The situation for humanity is extraordinarily serious. This climate change problem is an existential crisis for the species. If we go to 3 degrees, there won't be an ecosystem on the planet that won't be shredded by that. We're at 1.2, 1.3 degrees warming already, Celsius. If we go to 3 degrees Celsius, we aren't going to be able to feed the 10 billion plus people who will be on the planet then. There is no possibility of anything resembling liberal democracy to survive in a planet of 3 degrees Celsius. All the human rights and freedoms we've come to love. So everything is on the line right now. But I still think that there's at least that 20% possibility there for turning things around. In part because we see human beings can change so dramatically,
yes,
so quickly, as we did in the pandemic.
That's right. That's right. Interesting also, I'm going to read two other quotes that I found because they both are about memory and the past. One was theologian Walter Brueggemann, who says, memory produces hope in the same way that amnesia produces despair.
Mm-hmm.
And George Orwell, who controls the past controls the future, who controls the present controls the past. So there's something about we've done good before. We've overcome challenge before?
Yes. Yes. So this is really interesting, Terrence. And you're the first person in all the interviews I've done to actually pursue this particular question. So I talk in the book quite a bit about the issue of our recursive minds, basically our capacity to think about ourselves thinking and to think about ourselves in the past or in the future, aware of our circumstances at that time. It's an extraordinary capacity human beings have. It's probably one of the principal tools that we have, cognitive tools we have to allow us to master our environments, to be able to travel through time. So what we do is we use our memories of events and experiences we've had or things we've learned about the world through talking to or learning about other people and other civilizations. And we, in a sense, we We divide all of those up into little, like letters or words in an alphabet or in sentences. So those what you would call episodic memories become somewhat divorced from their context, but they become packages of information of ideas that we can then combine in new ways into new kinds of sentences that tell us new stories about possible futures. And without that episodic memory, without that deep reservoir of experiences that we can then use with our imaginations and recombine in new ways, we couldn't have the possibility for hope. I argue that most powerful forms of hope have an object, that they have a vision, a defined vision of where we want to go, of a future that's positive. It doesn't have to be really specific in the details, but it has to have a powerful emotional draw. I try to develop an idea for a positive future, which I call the renew the future worldview at the end of the book.
Well, I mean, this is the hope too, right?
That's the hope too. And we the hope too makes us lean forward towards that possibility. And we create that possibility by taking our memories and recombining them in new ways to create a new picture of the future. And we do it so often. Novelists do it. And when we read a novel, we fall into that world, and we become part of that world. We need to create the same possibilities for the future. We will not survive unless we have that kind of positive story about the future, and unless there is a general consensus around the world of what that's going to look like, how we're going to live together on this, unfortunately, degraded planet in terms of its natural environment, how we're going to live together and prosper with nature, in sense in collaboration with nature on this planet going forward.
You know, a quote that really resonates with me that I happened to read just after the 2016 election, so just after the election of Trump, is by Antoine Saint-Exupéry, most famous for The Little Prince. The quote is, "If you want to build a ship, don't drum up the men to gather wood, divide the work, and give orders. Instead, teach them to yearn for the vast and endless sea." And to me, that is to on the story side, on the narrative side, that is one of our great tasks, is to generate a vision of the future that is as compelling, inviting, and real as the past that some people, Trump
Yes.
voters, for instance, fondly remember.
They want to go back to. That's
That's
right.
right. And so
Right.
what is this compelling narrative that can drive us to yearn for a future richer
Yes.
than the one we want to go back to? And
That's right.
if that takes you into your renew the
Renew the future
yeah renew the
worldview.
future scenario or
Yes.
approach, take it there.
So I like the metaphor of yearning for the vastness of the sea, but I want to push it a bit further. I think in a sense the sea is the pathway. It's the substrate of the pathway. We sail across the sea to get where we're going. There's something else. We need a continent or an island that we're aiming towards, and we need to be able to envision what's there a little bit. And when you think about the great explorers in history, the crazy things they did, whether it was Franklin or Columbus or Vasco da Gama or whoever, they had an image of where they were going. They had and sometimes it was fantastical, sometimes not, but they had a sense for what the possibility was, and that was the object of their hope. And I try at the end of the book to create that, in a sense, continent. We're going across this turbulent sea over the next decades and maybe the next century. It's going to be very dangerous, and we're not certain if we're going to actually make it to that new place. But this is what I think. This is its outline, at least its silhouette on the horizon. I don't get into the deep details, but I do create what I call a renew the future paradigm or a renew the future worldview, which is quite detailed in its specifics in terms of the principles on which it's founded, what this new world could look like. And I contrast it with what I think is its antithesis, which I label the Mad Max worldview, which is very Trumpian in its characteristics. It's grounded in deep assumptions about the essential difference between different groups of people between it, it's a perspective that looks to the past for inspiration. It's inclined towards violence. It wants to build barriers and walls to try to shut others out, to protect the core identity group. And so I do an analysis. I have some tools that I use to unpack worldviews that I provide for the readers at the end of the book. And I do an analysis of the Mad Max worldview, and then I contrast this with the Renew the Future worldview, which is much more optimistic and is centered on a notion of hope and a perspective on the future that is grounded in the principles of security, opportunity, justice, and identity.
Security, opportunity, justice, and identity. Mm-hmm. And then you talk about, and this goes back to the butterfly, it goes back to Stephanie May, you talk about a notion, you say, virtuous cascades of change, which I think goes back to our butterfly and goes back to Stephanie May. What does that mean?
You mentioned before that we tend to perceive these sudden shifts in negative terms, the shocks and cascading changes we see in our world, for instance, from the pandemic, are generally thought to be harmful to us. But that's not necessarily the case. I mean, there are times in history where things happen very fast in very positive directions. I talk in the book about hitchhiking all over South Africa in 1983, early 1983, at the time that Grand Apartheid was still very powerful. And my friend and I spent time with every racial group in South Africa, and there was a complete consensus across these groups, people we talked to, that apartheid was going to end because the cracks were showing, but there was going to be a racial bloodbath. There was going to be enormous violence as a result. And yet that didn't happen. If somebody had said at that time that Nelson Mandela would be released from prison and would cooperate, negotiate with President de Klerk the democratic and peaceful transition to a multiracial democracy in South Africa, if we'd laid out that vision of the future, people would have said, that's impossible. That's complete foolishness. And yet that cascade of change did take place. And the question is, can we institute this kind of transformation at a global level? And I think that there are changes in the way humanity has organized itself, our extraordinary connectivity around the planet, the sense that we have now, I think, an emerging feeling of shared fate on this planet, that we're either going to survive together or die together, that create the possibility for planet-wide virtuous cascades of change, especially in the way we perceive each other and the possibilities of surviving together. So these shifts have happened sometimes at the level of individual societies like South Africa, and sometimes globally. In the past, there was a remarkable change called the Axial Age between 600 BCE and 200 BCE, where five major civilizations on the planet all shifted their cosmologies and worldviews simultaneously, even without much communication with each other. And we may be in a circumstance, I think, today where we're looking at something like this century that we might call the second axial age, where there's a dramatic jump in the cognition and understanding and the moral frameworks of humanity.
You know, one thing I want to make sure that we haven't left out, we've talked about climate change, we've talked about the pandemic, but I just want to say, this conversation has not been ignorant of, though we don't have time to talk about it really, of what's going on negatively between us as people. That and I'm going to read a quote of yours, that as people become hesitant and anxious, as their faith in progress shrinks, they become more inclined to talk to each other in the emotional cadences of doubt and fear. The stories they tell about their future become muted and drained of excitement and positive possibility, and we shift toward tribalism. We begin to fear the other and so on. So as I said, we don't have time to really talk about that, but I want to say that we're not ignoring that, and we're not Pollyannishly pretending that that is not an avenue where these same crises can push people.
Not at all. In fact, all the way through the book, I counterpose the particular arguments I'm developing against what, as I call it, the Mad Max perspective, this possibility of a descent into, which I think is actually perhaps more likely than the positive outcome.
Yes.
A descent into extraordinary violence and kind of tribal divisions between us around the world, as the emotion of fear becomes dominant. So it's really a contest between our emotional orientations, hope and positivity versus fear and anger. And I set that up very explicitly at the end of the book using these analytical tools that I offer the reader that actually pull out in very explicit form what the negative Mad Max worldview looks like and what the positive Renew the Future worldview looks like. And it's not at all clear which pathway we're going to follow.
Right, right. As you say, hope depends on some sense of possibility. Likewise, fear often depends on some, or at least realistic fear depends on the possibility of those negative consequences. I must tell you, having brought up the Mad Max thing, that I recently suffered something which happens a lot, and is happening more and more, at least in California, and I think it's spreading the rest of the country, which is that someone in the middle of the night stole the catalytic converter from Prius.
Wow. Right? Wow.
And this is now epidemic. Why? Because there are precious metals.
Yes, platinum.
And it's a quick thing that they can remove. My wife's response was, given the pandemic, the economic devastation, we are coming into a more Mad Max reality where there are people who go around stealing catalytic converters for the precious metals. We're at the end of this conversation, Thomas. What I want to read is one last quote. To believe in the possible and to make the possible real, we must recognize the right kind of hope can be a tool of change, and we must give our hope the muscle it requires in our present crisis. How do we do that?
Well, I could say something crass. Buy the book Commanding Hope. But I'm not entirely kidding. You know, I lay out in that book quite a detailed theory for how we can use hope in our individual lives and in our communities and in our actions on a day-to-day basis to feel more positively about the future, but also to make change much more effectively. So hope becomes then a source of motivation, a source of power within ourselves and within our societies. And, you know, there is an infinite number of things that we can all do, no matter what our walks of life, starting from conversations around the dinner table to our political activities, to the way we consume, the investments and charitable contributions we make to groups that can allow us to engage. And every one of us has that Stephanie May possibility in us. In a highly complex world that's full of tipping points, every one of us could be the next person, like a Greta Thunberg or somebody, to mobilize hundreds of thousands or even millions of people around the world to produce change. So it's an extraordinarily exciting time to be alive. It's a hinge moment in the history of our species. And I think there's no reason to believe that our story is finished yet. Our positive story is finished yet.
Okay. So again, the book is Commanding Hope, The Power We Have to Renew a World in Peril. Thomas has three websites I'm going to direct you to at this point. One is homerdixon.com. That's Homer Dixon, HOMERDIXON, no hyphen, homerdixon.com. The other is the one for the book, commandinghope.com. One word, Commanding Hope. And the third is cascadeinstitute.org. Cascade Institute, one word, .org. For this conversation and many other interviews and articles, to join me in pursuit of a world that just might work, go to terrencemcnally.net, terrencemcnally.net, or a world that just might work, all one word, a world that just might work.com. They're the same website. If you want to receive my weekly email announcement of guests and issues, plus links to probably 8 to 10 relevant and timely articles, you can sign up at my site, or you can email me at TEMCNALLY@mac.com. You can also subscribe and listen to the Freeform podcast on Apple Podcasts and most other podcast sites. You find years of podcasts there in a searchable form, which they often aren't at the podcast sites. Michael Lewis, Jeremy Scahill, Naomi Klein, Robert Reich, Van Jones, Connie Rice, Greg Boyle. You can follow me on Twitter at McNally Terrence. Thanks to G in production, George Vassilopoulos, the Progressive Voices, and most of all, you, my listeners. Please share this podcast widely. And finally, thank you, Thomas Homer Dixon. Keep up your good work.
Thank you so much.